The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So, thank you all for coming. And thanks to everyone who accomplished the quick change of the room, not quite as quick as we had hoped, but very quick indeed. And this is our panel on user-generated content and copyright, the conundrum thereof, and we have a terrific group of speakers who are going to take a little time to talk to you and then subject themselves to your questions. Rob Kasanick, who's I'm happy to say, even though we're coming to the end of the time, which I can say it's still a visiting professor of law here at the American University Washington College of Law, is going to moderate that discussion. But first, I want to introduce my collaborator on a variety of projects about media and fair use, Pat Aufderheide, who is a professor in the School of Communications, Center of Social Media, which she directs, to announce a piece of research that has been conducted in connection with today's events. Pat?
Those of you who know Peter Yassi know that he is almost pathologically modest. And that's why he forgot to tell you that he is a co-principal investigator on the research that we are releasing today as part of this panel. It's called The Good, the Bad, and the Confusing. And it's about user-generated video creators and their attitudes on copyright. I'd like to say thank you to Liz Nolan Brown, who is in the front row here, who conducted the research for the Center for Social Media and the Program on Information Justice and Intellectual Property. What it does is to provide the results of a survey and long-form open-ended interviews with college-age and college-educated young people who are making online videos about their assumptions, attitudes, and practices on copyright. Probably the most significant research result that we discovered was an astonishing amount of individual user confusion over what is correct, combined with a really surprising to us, remarkable amount of desire to comply with whatever they thought copyright might require of them. And it shows, we believe, the state of policy incoherence at this moment around user-generated copyright. So everybody who worked on this report is really eager to hear this panel speak about this. We encourage you all to take a copy of this report and to discuss it with us after the panel.
Thanks, Pat. To get us started today, I want to introduce our panelists, and we do have a great group of people here with us today. To my immediate right is Steve Tapia, who is at Microsoft and has practiced entertainment, media, and intellectual property law for 23 years and also served as a business executive for 5 years. He's currently is a senior attorney in Microsoft's law and corporate affairs department, specializing in copyright law. And until the end of 2004, Steve was senior director business development of MSN's entertainment channel and related businesses. To his immediate right, we have Sarah Deutsch, who is vice president and associate general counsel for Verizon Communications. Her practice covers a wide range of legal issues in the area of global internet policy, liability, privacy, intellectual property policy, spam, spyware, and internet jurisdiction. She has represented Verizon on a host of domestic and international internet issues, ranging from digital rights management, RIAA versus Verizon litigation, the broadcast flag, and was one of the 5 negotiators for the U.S. telecommunications industry who negotiated service provider provisions that resulted in the passage of Section 512 of the Title 17, part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. To Sarah's right is Fred Von Lohman. is a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in intellectual property issues. In that role, he's represented programmers, technology innovators, and individuals in litigation against every major record label, movie studio, and television network, as well as several cable TV networks and music publishers in the United States. In addition to litigation, he's involved in EFF's efforts to educate policymakers regarding the proper balance between intellectual property protection and the public interest in fair use, free expression, and innovation. To Fred's right is Mike Remington, who is a partner at the law firm of Drinker, Biddle, and Reith, and has almost 30 years of experience in intellectual property law, copyrights, trademarks, patents, and semiconductor chip mask works, court reform, and governmental relations. For 9 years, he was chief counsel of the Judiciary Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives on Intellectual Property and Judicial Administration. Mike is also an adjunct faculty member at George Mason School of Law and Catholic University's Columbus School of Law. And to Mike's right is Alec French, who is vice president for governmental relations at NBC Universal. And prior to joining NBC Universal, Alec was minority counsel to the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Courts, the Internet, and Intellectual Property, where he was actively involved in the development of intellectual property legislation. Prior to that, Alec was legislative counsel to the Electronic Software Association. And as to Alec's right, of course, is Professor Peter Yazzie, who is the director of Washington College of Law's program on information justice and intellectual property. He's a longtime professor of copyright and most recently the recipient of the 2007 L. Ray Patterson Copyright Award for support of users' rights. So I want to thank all of our panelists and for coming today. And rather than set this up in any way with telling you stories, we know there's been a lot of issues with the purchase of user-generated content platforms like YouTube, with Google's purchase of that for $1.65 billion, with the recent litigation with Viacom against YouTube. We thought in order to get some understanding of what this content was, what better way than to view it? So we were going to create a public performance of some of this content right now. Maybe while we're getting the technical difficulties straightened out, what we're going to do is have each of our panelists provide about 5 to 7 minutes for about 5 minutes of introductory statement. So while we're getting this worked out, how about if we start with that, and maybe if we can just go down the row, and perhaps Steve, you could provide some comments.
Microsoft is kind of uniquely positioned around this thing, this whole topic, because we play in all of the different facets of the diamond, so to speak. We have a site that is called Soapbox that is, I hate to hesitate to call it YouTube Lite. If any of you have been there, you may be the only other person other than me that's been there. But we also create the tools that a lot of people use to create user-generated content. And then we have content ourselves that gets mashed up on a quite regular basis, or at least gets used a lot. Bill has a tendency to find himself being the star of a lot of videos that he wasn't actually a part of. And so as a result, we have kind of an interesting quandary in terms of where we come down on these kinds of things. The thing that I think, though, that is most important is I think we're committed, as I think almost all of my fellow panelists are, is to trying to get this one right. There's so much that has sort of just been left to the free market, if you will, or just to market forces to try to sort of figure out exactly what the long-term answer is going to be. And there's so much at stake with this one in particular. There's so many people that are participating. And earlier today, I was reminded of how many people are actually having their first programming experience doing a lot of the kinds of things that you see and what you're going to see quite a few of in a minute. And it's a great, great user tool. And on a regular basis, I have people call me up and sort of say, you know, last night I built this great software that does, and then they proceed to tell me what it is, and after my heartburn goes away, I proceed to try to tell them why, well, this is a great thing that is going to help people do, you know, mashups of web pages or mashups of whatever much, much better. It's not necessarily the kind of thing that the world's quite prepared for from a legal standpoint. So there's a lot of creativity, not just in the content, but also in the tool standpoint that we have to sort of toe the line on a daily basis. The thing that is really interesting to me, though, and it's readily apparent time and time and time again, is this is one of those great areas where the First Amendment, you know, a very altruistic kind of free love kind of amendment, if there ever was one, comes in direct conflict with a capitalist notion of copyright. And it seems like all the fun is where those two things come into conflict. And here's what it is that I'll leave you with. I actually think that this, much like other forms of content regulation, defamation in particular, suffers from a real problem that the paradigm that we exist now around all kinds of content regulation just doesn't take into account. And let me try to explain it this way. If you look at defamation law in particular, and I know that very few of you, if you're here for a copyright talk, probably are defamation experts, but bear with me for a second. If you've taken First Amendment law, you'll know what I'm talking about. It assumes that time is available for somebody to sort of have a contemplative review of what's out there. So, for example, if you look at the normal retraction statutes that are in almost every state statute about defamation, about what you're supposed to do, it assumes that there's an editor somewhere who's taking a look at what somebody posted in the first place and said, yeah, you know, I think we're going to run with that. We'll put it on page two. It's not page one material, but we're going to run with it. And, you know, hopefully it's been fact-checked and copy-checked and all of those kinds of things. And we'll put it up there. And then it assumes that that person is still there to receive a retraction notice and say, oh, we goofed. You know, so we're going to put it in the prominent place, and the dialogue went exactly one day. It was in the paper on Tuesday, you retracted on Wednesday, and on Thursday, everyone's just as good off as they needed to be, and no harm done. What do you do in a website, or what do you do in a blog, where all of a sudden there's no longer that editorial contemplative voice, or there's even the sense of what's equal prominence mean? You know, if the damage is done or the bell's already rung in the current environment, then you really have a problem from defamation standpoint. And I see the same thing happening with user-generated content, and here's what I mean. When I talk to all of our business partners in Hollywood, one of the things that they tell me is, look, we love the DMCA, we voted for it in the first place, but it's really hurting us now, and you've got to try to help us come to a way to figure out how to do this, because what's happened is while you move from a digital to an analog world, meaning when I have to actually send you a notice, for example, you've got a certain amount of float in the amount of time there, and that's where all the damage is done. So again, much like in the defamation standpoint, where there's an assumption under a lot of the DMCA that there's a responsible adult behind the scenes that can receive a notice and take action on it. In the new world, you don't necessarily have that. And it's, even though it's only 12, 13 years old, the DMCA is kind of becoming very much like another victim of Web 2.0 in terms of what's happened to time.
I guess I'll just make a couple of points. I think when the DMCA was negotiated, it was always clear that user-generated content was part of the equation, and we got into some very difficult discussions at the time when the content community would ask for something about who was going to be covered by the scope of the DMCA. And it was clear that it would cover not only large content owners, but all owners, including small user-generated content. And this is why, and we can talk about this later, but provisions like notice and takedown was not accepted on a napkin, which was, you know, kind of a proposal that was being discussed at some point. We would get a phone call, we would take it down. The counter notification and kind of the what we call putback was there because there was a presumption that harm would come to a user if their work was taken down. And the misrepresentation section, and by the way, those both have some poison pills in them that we can talk about, but originally the intent was to punish people who would use this for mischief, and again, hurt the kind of small users whose works would be taken down. the tensions, I think, come from not really from not having a responsible adult at home, because at least in our ISP industry, there is an adult there, and they're waiting for the notices. It really comes from, I think, technology and automation. Everything is automated on both sides. So P2P was a new type of technology that we didn't know how to deal with that was handled in the Grokster litigation. We now have the ease at, through which user-generated content can be posted, which is creating tensions. On the other end of the equation, when we negotiated the DMCA, we never envisioned that all these notices would be automated, that there would be these computerized search bots like the little spiders in the Matrix kind of scouring the web and sending notices, and that we would be flooded with these things. And Verizon receives thousands and thousands of these notices every year. Many of them are invalid because they don't relate to material that resides on our website, yet we continue to get them, and we continue to get false notices, especially from the pornography industry, who fully exercise their First Amendment rights as copyright owners. I guess we'll also discuss on this panel the Viacom YouTube case. I don't really see it as a surprise. I don't think Google saw it as a surprise. In fact, they were amassing a war chest to defend against this kind of suit when they bought YouTube. What the case really should be about is best practices. Did they have best practices in place? Whether Google has red flag knowledge under the DMCA, whether it was aware of facts and circumstances from which infringing activity is apparent. Instead, the danger is that this case is now not just about taking out Google and YouTube, but it's really a broad attack on the DMCA itself. And I think what's at risk is that there's going to be a notion that will rewrite the DMCA. So there may be a notion that if we have something called mere conduit under the DMCA, they would like to have a notion called mere host. If you do something more than be a passive host, then maybe you should have liability. There's a duty in the case at issue of whether there's a duty to filter and monitor, which is another bite at the Grokster issue. And this, again, is something that's directly contradicted by the DMCA itself and the case law like CoStar v. LoopNet and Perfect 10 case that have held there is no duty to monitor, even if you get repeated notices. So, again, I look forward to talking with everyone further on the panel about these issues.
Thanks, Sarah. Fred?
So in the legal fights that are currently underway relating to user-generated content, or as Professor Pat Aufderheide, I think, says, has coined a much better phrase, participatory media, there are two, I think, bigger issues at stake that I would urge everybody to keep in mind, that we're going to get lost very quickly in minutiae about particular companies and particular provisions of the law. But the two big issues I wanted to keep an eye on here are fair use and innovation. And on the fair use side, I want to emphasize, since the dawn of the broadcast media era, the American public has never seen all the fair use to which it's entitled under the law. Why? Because in the past, if you had a great video, if you made a film, if you made music, something that incorporated somebody else's content perhaps, if you wanted to get that on TV or on the radio or distributed in movie theaters, you had to get their general counsel to sign off on it first. And they would always say, well, have you cleared every clip? Have you cleared every scrap of music? Is it all absolutely original? And if you couldn't give the right answers to those questions, you never made it to mainstream media, and most people never saw what you had to say. Despite the fact that lots of those kinds of uses are permitted and have always been nominally permitted under the law of fair use. So thanks to these websites, thanks to things like YouTube, Google Video, Yahoo Video, MySpace, all of these new sites, for the first time, the American public is actually getting the full fair use to which it has always been entitled, because you don't need to satisfy a lawyer before you can upload to YouTube. You don't need to get errors and omissions insurance before you upload music to MySpace. And in these debates, I think it's important that we try to preserve that, that we not go back to a permission first, creativity later model that I think has for too long been a lodestone around a lot of the kinds of media that we've grown up with. The second issue is innovation. The thing that I think a lot of people forget is not so very long ago, in fact, about 2 years ago, YouTube was just a bunch of clever guys with an idea. And, you know, MySpace was just the same thing, and Facebook was a handful of college dropouts. And from those beginnings, people have come up with these incredible new businesses and new opportunities for creativity. And as we discuss the legal norms surrounding user-generated content, or participatory media if you prefer, I urge you to keep in mind their perspective. It's not about whether YouTube survives. It's not about whether MySpace survives. It's about whether the next YouTube survives, whether the next MySpace makes it into, you know, survives the legal confusion that is surrounding these issues. Because we want, it's, you know, as my friend Cory Doctorow likes to say, the value of that which has not been invented yet always exceeds the value of everything that has been invented so far. And so I urge us to keep that in mind as well as we try to not get lost in the legalese.
Mike?
Thank you. Thank you, Peter and Rob, for inviting me to be on this panel. In 1996 or so, I remember having lunch with Mitch Kapoor, the founder of EFF, and Francis Preston, the then president and CEO of Broadcast Music, Inc., which I represent here in Washington, D.C., just the three of us. To the best of my recollection, Mitch described a future of libraries without books, distribution of music from celestial, and a world where users were authors and authors were users. Francis described no music without authorship. Protection of authors depends on licensing, fairness in licensing, and a vibrant copyright law. Without copyright, the expectation of remuneration, making a living, evaporates. Ask yourself whether you'd go into the music business if you couldn't get paid. This amicable conversation between these two visionaries lasted perhaps 30 minutes or so. I do believe that Mitch and Francis 10 years ago did see the future that we're seeing today. On behalf of BMI, a paradigm shift occurred. BMI went into internet licensing and created the first online accessible database. The BMI also created and invested in a wholly owned subsidiary. This is pretty radical for a rights society, Landmark Digital Services, which owns patented digital audio recognition technology called Blue Arrow. And some we discussed that earlier today. Blue Arrow uses pattern recognition to identify performance from any source containing audio. Mitch went on to teach at the MIT Media Labs, to run the Mitchell Kapoor Foundation, which is focused on improving human well-being, and to chairing several very important public interest foundations. I'm not here as a representative of BMI today, but I thought this story might stimulate your thinking about seeing the future. I just want to briefly, and I'll pick up on these threads later, hit three items related to user-generated rights. The congressional role in facing technological changes, the long-term value of copyright law, and the key part played by education and conferences like this one. I'm never shocked by the ability of the U.S. government to confront changes that occur in society. The whole history of the United States is a history of change. Our founding fathers contemplated that when it wrote the first three articles of the Constitution. Now, admittedly, the law becomes frayed in places. User-generated rights may be one of those places. But I don't consider this problem to be any more difficult than the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which Sarah covered, and I too was one of the negotiators, albeit on the content owner side. Or issues faced by the courts, for example, in the Napster and Grokster decisions. Copyright law has survived enormous technological changes, perhaps somewhat the worse for wear, but invariably arising to the challenges. We should admire its resiliency. What I think is important about copyright law is that it permits creators to be paid. We can't forget that. The copyright bar and the beneficiaries of the copyright law have a big role to play in copyright education. Even with potential liabilities looming, and they're enormous in the Viacom and YouTube case, the lack of understanding about the law is a significant societal problem. I had a personal experience with that because in 2003 and 2006, I authored white papers for the Joint Committee of the Higher Education and Entertainment Committees on copyright law and potential liability for students engaged in P2P file sharing on university networks. That was quite an experience for me to achieve a textual agreement between the RIAA, the MPAA, and the university community with reviews by two college presidents, president of Stanford and the president of Penn State. It took a while, but it was done. Even with educational materials now posted on university websites, you still find statements like one recently posted at Purdue University. A student wrote, after reading a speech by Mary Beth Peters, the Register of Copyrights, Mary Beth said that it was copyright infringement to, quote, distribute, reproduce, or publicly perform. She covered the exclusive rights under copyright law without authorization. The student wrote that it was therefore okay to, quote, download, because downloading is not an exclusive right. We have a lot of work to do in the educational realm. In any event, I'm thankful again to Peter and this conference, and indeed by the Copyright Society, which does do a wonderful job about copyright education. Let me conclude about a recent book that one of my kids gave me, Freakonomics, which provides a leisurely walk through the arcane world of economics. The authors, Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubner, ask questions like, how much do parents really matter? What kind of impact did Roe v. Wade have on violent crime? What do sumo wrestlers and school teachers have in common? Now, I'm not going to give you the answers to those questions because you have to read the book. But I will share the common thread that runs through this book. Solving problems like the copyright conundrum discussed this afternoon often require a novel way of thinking. You may end up asking a lot of questions. Many of those questions will lead you nowhere, but some will lead to answers. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Alec?
Thanks. I'm glad that Pat came up with a new term, participatory media, because I think user-generated content is just a terrible title. I think it's inaccurate, and it's frankly pretty dull. I think it just doesn't cover, I mean, it seems like people are using this term to cover everything from simply posting a clip of one of my company's products, like an SNL clip, on the internet without any change, which isn't generated by a user. It's simply them uploading something someone else has created, you know, at one end of the spectrum all the way to the other end of the spectrum, you know, creating a mashup that has some original content in it, some copyrighted content all put together. And so I just think the term is wrong, and I think we should try to push towards a new term like participatory media. I think that's a lot more accurate. My company, you know, like as part of the movie and the TV business, constantly gets accused of being a dinosaur, a Luddite, I think was the term used in a recent Wall Street Journal article. I think it was the Mossberg article, or it may have been Lawrence Lessig. I'm not sure which. First, I want to take that on. I mean, you know, I've been at my company for 2 years now, and I've been really excited to be part of a company that is so interested in developing new business models. It gets it. It gets it that consumers want content anywhere, anytime, at different price points in ways that are convenient for them. We've rolled out a ton of new business models. You can get our TV shows online, streamed from our websites, ad-supported. Last night's Heroes, last week's 30 Rock, you can download them from iTunes. You can go back and find Meet the Presses from 6 months ago and stream them through an archive we have. All of our news programs, actually, through MSNBC.com are streamable. Podcasts of them. Same with movies. You know, we do movie rental services online through tons of different services. MovieLink, Walmart, we do movie downloads, Cinema Now, Walmart again. We use peer-to-peer to do movie rentals, a service called Peer Impact. We do download-to-burn through Cinema Now. You can download a movie and burn it to a DVD. You can download through Walmart and do backup copies, one for a portable, one for your hard drive. My company has really jumped into the space of making our content available in new ways, recognizing, as we've been told, that our old business models are going to die. and that the new business models are in the new marketplaces. Now, one of those new business models, one of those new opportunities is clearly participatory media. Going in, this is clearly something consumers want to do with our media. They want an ability to use our media in ways that really haven't been available before, at least in the digital world. And that's an attractive new area for us to make our content available. We're doing it there, too. We have a site called It's Your TV that is actually a site that allows consumers, people to come online. We do contests where we set out challenges for people to create content based on themes, and then people go out and create it. We get it rated. If it's good enough, we give prizes. You know, $50,000, I think, is the top prize. There, we have a site called dotcomedy.com, which is a site where all of these famous SNL clips that you've heard of, the Chronicles of Narnia, and I won't say the name of the other one, are available. And, you know, we use clips from My Name is Earl, from 30 Rock, from The Office to drive people to the site. They're all available there and streamable. But on the site, we offer people the opportunities to, for instance, submit jokes or kind of topical jokes on news. And then we have a newscaster who will read the jokes as if it's the evening newscast. We offer people the opportunity to put their own webisodes up there, their own clips of content that they've created, and essentially create a site for them to put their own content up there. But we use our content, frankly, as a draw for people to go to that site. And, of course, we're making money there off of ads. And then many of you may have heard about our most recent announcement. I think it was just 2 weeks ago. We announced that along with News Corp and MySpace, AOL, Yahoo, and Microsoft, that we're going to create a new aggregated site for all of our content, basically. Now, a lot of this is already out there and available, as I've described elsewhere, but this is going to be an aggregated site where you're going to be able to do stream on demand, free but ad-supported on-demand streaming of our TV shows, and again, all of our stuff is out there that we own, and of many movies, library movies, and then electronic sell-through, it's called, downloadable to own movies. Available at one site, we're going to offer people the ability to clip. We're going to offer people the ability to embed. You set up a MySpace page, you want to refer someone to a great Office clip that you like, you'll be able to do that, just obviously very much like you can do on YouTube now. There's going to be, in other words, a user-generated element to it. So we see, user-generated content or participatory media as something that consumers really desire to be able to do with our content. And clearly, we're fine with offering it. But when it's our stuff and people are doing what would otherwise be a copyright infringement, and I know this is a fine line to draw, we feel that it's our right to be the ones to profit from that. We feel it's our right to be the ones to either say to someone else, we'll license you. You've offered us a good deal. We see it as good value for our content. We will license you the ability to offer our content to your consumers in that way. Or we want to set up our own site, like we've done in this case, and offer consumers the ability to use our content directly from us. If someone wants to make our copyrighted works available, our SNL clips or whatever, they should get a license from us. If they don't want to get a license from us, then they should make sure that what goes on their platform is non-infringing or is fair use. They should, in other words, prevent infringement. Now, here we get into a little bit of, Sarah talked about the DMCA covering user-generated content, 512. I don't think that's accurate. The DMCA covers ISPs and gives them an exemption from liability when they are, in fact, doing what the DMCA sets out. The question is, when are you an ISP and when are you aren't? I mean, they seem to draw the conclusion, and I guess we'll get into arguments on the law, that YouTube somehow falls into it. I think our attitude is clearly YouTube does not fall under the safe harbors. So if our position is that if you have our content on your website and you do not want to take a license from us for the ability to offer it, then you should be preventing others from infringing. To us, the answer on how you do that, unfortunately, the experience with YouTube so far has shown that some of the things they've tried to do, notice and takedown, limiting the time of the content that people can store to 10 minutes,
suspending repeat infringers, but none of that has frankly worked. Someone gets suspended from YouTube, they just re-register with a different username, they're back up, posting it the next day. Notice and takedown has clearly not worked on YouTube because the stuff gets reposted. 10-minute clips, it's a good try, but SNL skits are under 10 minutes, and you can aggregate, of course, all the clips together, and someone can then watch the movie. Our answer is what the site should be doing, again, if they're going to use our content or offer their users the ability to use our content, is to filter. There are some very promising technologies out there that enable sites to, and it requires a good amount of work from us to register our works, but once works are registered in a database, sites, as many universities across the country are now doing, ISPs as well, can filter out infringing works. And that is what we think is the best solution at this point. It's not perfect. Clearly there are some issues, but on balance, when you have a massive infringement problem out there like you do today, we think that the default at this point should be to implement technology that generally works at a very, very high percentage level, figure out where it may have imperfections, work those out, but that really is the solution for a lot of the participatory media sites that are out there not operating under any license. I guess I'll close it there. Thanks.
Thanks, Alec. Peter?
I wonder if we could go to the video and
we'll see.
Evolution of dicks. This is my doc. My uncle. Doc Brown. Have you ever been in a situation where you knew you had to act a certain way?
Meet Jack Torrance. He's a writer looking for inspiration. Meet Danny. He's a kid looking for a dad.
At Pharaoh High, Ramses was the biggest player around.
No doubt.
But when the new kid in school...
I am a stranger in this strange land.
...realized hanging with the in crowd wasn't so easy, he took a stand. 10 things I hate about commandments.
Mana, mana. Mana, mana. Mana, mana.
There's only you in my life, the only thing that's right.
Experienced, hardworking, patriotic people who want to be part of a team, the American team.
What of all his talk about truth?
Truth
was the biggest lie of all.
Truthiness, Stephen? More like falsiness.
Switching to Ball State men's tennis, it seems last week player on... It seems every week that you have a player...
The Winnebago Concepts and Engineering Departments have developed a multifunctional bathroom. Privacy, I don't even know what the f*** I'm reading.
What is the meaning of this?
The meaning of what?
Chad, I heard you're having some problems with Clint.
Clint is a fool, and I will not tolerate his insolence much longer.
Well, you're going to have to resolve it. Can't have my day manager and my night manager at each other's throats all the time.
Yes, Emperor.
Randy!
Oh, crikey!
Where to the mother?
So we come full circle to the point at which we began with Pat's introduction of the research report that show that there is a lot of deep confusion and uncertainty among people who produce participatory media objects of the kind that we've just been seeing about what's fair, and literally to localize that ethical question to the domain of the law about what's fair use. And it turns out that uncertainty is not unique to participatory media producers. It's also true that if you ask a lot of people who are experts on copyright law, you will get a range of views on that question. Probably different people have different understandings of how that question should be answered as respects each of the clips that are part of that compilation and all the other content that's available on the various platforms as well. The critical piece, or one of the critical pieces of the research that we're introducing today, is the information, which doesn't really come as a surprise, but is, I think, very important to recognize, and that Pat underlined earlier, that producers want to know answers to this question. People who are making participatory media are genuinely concerned, for reasons that are both related to potential legal exposure, but also for reasons that are ethically grounded, about whether or not their practices fall within the range of the permissible or outside that range. And it turns out, I think, that question is also of interest to others. Fred made a critical point earlier, which is that the protections offered by Section 512, as Sarah described it, have allowed a tremendous amount of creativity to flourish in this participatory media space, but still, the platforms, as they mature as companies, are interested themselves in the answer to that question: what is fair, what is fair use? And that interest is likely to grow as movements toward some form of filtering of content on platforms, whatever we may think about those movements and however they may come about, as a result of voluntary action, as a result of contractual undertakings, or as a result of responses to litigation. As those movements take place, I think we all recognize, Alec underlined it very clearly, that it's important that if content is going to be filtered, fair use content should not be filtered. So the question then arises, how can the content of this important legal concept as applied to this brand new and exciting form of media practice be established, clarified, elucidated? And there are a number of different ways that could be done. One would be to go to Congress and to ask for a statutory revision, a new take or a new cut at Section 107 of the Copyright Act, the fair use provision, which would be more precise than the current broadly worded multi-factor test that Section 107 gives us. I think a lot of us who are committed to the fair use principle are really quite concerned about the efficacy as well as the downside risks of that sort of an approach to clarification. It could work, or it could be a disaster. Another possibility is to do a big sort of multi-party negotiation to get every possible stakeholder in this space, from the teenage digital content wizards to the largest content owners, together in some kind of a negotiation setting to hammer out agreed upon principles. And all I can say is that it's been a long time since that approach to clarifying fair use has worked. Indeed, it's arguable that that approach to clarifying fair use has never worked, that it's often had really negative consequences, because often what has been established as a floor through negotiations has turned out to be interpreted as a ceiling. There is a third possibility, and that's one that we here in American University, through the collaboration of the program here in the law school and the Center of Social Media for Social Media in the School of Communications, have been and are continuing to explore. And that's this notion that some of you will have heard about, of devising best practices in fair use which represent the consensus of a particular set of media practitioners about what's fair within their particular discipline. And the most developed version of that was the Documentary Filmmakers Statement of Best Practices in Fair Use that we worked on with the national organizations that represent documentary filmmakers, released about a year and a half ago, and which has since very quickly become something like an industry standard on this issue within the field of documentary filmmaking. Broadcasters, insurers, as well as filmmakers, all have rallied around this statement, and so far at least, it's had a very liberating effect on filmmaking practice. So a question, and I will, as befits a discussion like this, leave it as a question, is whether such an exercise is possible in the domain of what we have until very recently been calling user-generated content, and now we're going to try to call, at least until we can come up with some better term, participatory media. Whether one can imagine a community within this extremely diverse set of practitioners that could come together to talk about what's fair and what's not fair. There's a tremendous amount of promise in that idea, I think, but there also are many difficulties that we haven't faced before in these efforts to devise best practices. And if anyone is interested, we can talk more about that.
Thanks. I'd like to give an opportunity for some of the panelists to respond to some of the comments that they've heard. And it just in terms of also like to add in a thought that I'd like panelists to consider is, to what extent is this participatory media platform really the result of Section 512? Would we be in this situation were it not for having this type of setup within the statute that is separate from considerations of fair use and intermediaries? And also consider to what extent does Section 512 underprotect, as we're hearing, the need for maybe finding filtering or some other forms of additional protection for copyright owners? And what ways does it perhaps overprotect, where takedown notices are sent, but the corresponding counter notices perhaps don't sufficiently recognize non-infringing uses of works? So, Steve?
Sure. Let me see if I can try to kill off all three of those in one. Sarah was taking issue with what I said, there's no adult that's responsible behind it. I think for companies like Verizon, a good partner of Microsoft, and Microsoft, to the extent that we act as ISPs, my characterization wasn't intended for us. I know both companies pride themselves very strongly on being very, very prompt in their DMCA takedown notices. What I meant was this, and I ellipted it, so let me try to made it very hieroglyphic, but let me tell you what I think I mean. I am firmly convinced that if we shut down the established platforms, as we're calling them now today, meaning YouTube and all of its ilk that are by reputable businesses, there will almost miraculously spring up in its place places that will make that same content available without the imprimatur or without the adult supervision, if you will, of a Verizon or a Microsoft. Because once people have gotten a taste of what it's capable of, they're going to be able to figure out exactly how to do it without having to do it in an organized place. The tools are there. It's no longer where there is a set of people that control the software development in such a way that it only can be handled in, you know, I guess I'm going to use the term loosely, socially acceptable formats. They are clearly going to continue. And because this kind of stuff is becoming so popular and because it's generating so much creative user activity, I guarantee you that there's gonna be that explosion out there. So what I meant by time being the worst enemy of it is, and I'm sure Alec and I have never had a chance to meet, but if I kind of know where his company is coming from, and I know that we're trying in some respects to walk that tightrope of helping them and at the same time being mindful of our responsibility as good stewards of the copyright law. But one of the things that they will tell you is because of the way that some other companies are acting that aren't necessarily the outlaws, if you will, that are not necessarily Verizon and Microsoft, that are a little less fastidious in terms of how quickly they will pull things down, they're in a world of pain. So I'm sure, Alec, if I asked you, that the place in time that you guys probably go most nuts is on Sunday morning when everybody that forgot to set their DVRs go looking for Saturday Night Live clips from the night before. And I'm sure that all the, and again, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but if we had a chance to talk, you would probably tell me if there was a way that you could stop it by Sunday morning, I would be a lot happier than having to send you a notice and takedown in an analog form and somewhere between 48 and 72 hours later, you pull it down. And that's what I meant, that time right now is making everything such an incredibly supercharged environment where everything is taking on an extremely new set of meaning. Because what they have found is that the business models work. In those 24 to 48 hours, there's a huge opportunity to make lots and lots of money. So whereas before it was just kind of, oh, it's cute, they forgot to set their DVR, now there's a lot of money at stake. So I think it's a really interesting dialogue, and I think that while there are almost everybody that's here, I think, has acted reputably, there are a lot of folks that haven't.
I guess I would agree with a lot of what Steve said. I think, though, that many of these participatory media sites did develop because of the DMCA safe harbors, and you can see that because the definition of service provider, one of the definitions, it means a provider of online services or network access or the operator or facilities thereof. And so that's been very broadly interpreted. If eBay and Amazon have been found to be ISPs, I would argue that these other sites have as well, and they've blossomed because of that. But can they do a better job? I would say yes. But the answer is not to rewrite the DMCA. It would be, again, through working on voluntary best practices to beef up some of these sites. I think the DMCA in some way overprotects, in some ways underprotects. One of the ways I think it underprotects is in the area of this counter notification that Rob mentioned. You can apparently only get something put back up if it was a result of mistake or misidentification. And that language kind of was snuck in by some of our negotiators as a way to take some of the sting out. They didn't want everything being put back up. And this has, I think, severely limited the ability for example, just for non-infringing work or fair use to go back up. The other area that's been somewhat troubling in the DMCA is the misrepresentation section. That was supposed to be in there to give teeth. So if somebody used some mischief to try to take works down, there would be some penalties. But language was, again, put in at the last minute that the misrepresentation has to be knowing and material. And it's very hard to show that something was a knowing misrepresentation.
Well, I'm going to sort of echo a lot of what has already been said. I think it's indisputable that an enormous amount of investment in innovative companies and innovative products has flowed precisely where the DMCA safe harbors. I often like to say they're not really safe harbors. They're more like islands of certainty in an ocean of copyright uncertainty, and all the investment is seeking the dry land. There's no surprise there. That was part of, if you read the legislative history of the DMCA, what Congress had in mind when they passed the safe harbors. They wanted to create some certainty that would provide incentives for investment in this then relatively new technology called the Internet. Well, that part of the safe harbors has worked, I think, admirably well. It's no surprise that when you look at the largest Internet companies out there today, they are all clustered exactly where the DMCA safe harbors have created that certainty. So you have companies like Yahoo and Google who are built in the search space, which is specifically called out. You have all of the web hosting and businesses now extended by people like YouTube and MySpace, Google Video, Yahoo Video, Facebook, eBay, Amazon. All of those companies rely on the safe harbors for hosting, for search. You have ISPs like Verizon, AT&T, all of the largest ISPs all rely on the safe harbor for what they do, the conduit safe harbor. It's no accident that's where the investment, the innovation, and the economic growth has taken root. So I think we should act very carefully before we go heaving any of those guys back into the ocean, because frankly, there's a lot of countries out there that can build on these innovations. I mean, computers aren't unique to us. A network is not unique to us. If we want the United States to be where that economic growth occurs, it makes sense for us to protect that. Now, that being said, I also agree with those who've said that it wasn't everything we could have hoped for. Certainly, from EFF's perspective, if you're interested in protecting free speech and making sure that fair use has the ability to be up and stay up, the safe harbors didn't do as much as we would have liked. Viacom, for example, sent 100,000 takedown notices to YouTube on one day. 100,000 videos came down. As you might imagine, when you fish with a drift net, you catch some dolphins. And so sure enough, a lot of people's videos got taken down purely by, there was nothing in there that was Viacom's content. They just took them down because they were careless. They made mistakes. They took them down. One of the ones that was taken down was that video, the Stop the Falsiness, the parody of the Colbert Report that MoveOn did. And EFF has since sued Viacom for making, essentially what was clearly a misrepresentation about whether or not that was infringing. So I think there is still room for improvement. I hope that my hope for best practices is not best practices to make YouTube take down more stuff. My hope is for best practices whereby the right stuff gets taken down, the stuff that rights holders have the right to ask be removed, and not anything that happens to contain a little bit of content that they might own. The good news is, frankly, I've heard from the content owner community, from the large media companies, a real willingness to do that. They've, in my conversations with Viacom, they've been very reasonable. And so I'm hopeful that we can develop best practices that protect the great kinds of creative uses that you just saw up there, even if you don't get to watch Saturday Night Live on Sunday morning. Although on my final note, I'll note, if I record on my DVR Saturday Night Live in order to watch it Sunday morning, I don't pay a penny to NBC Universal, nor should I. So it's hard for me to see how even those kinds of uses are direct threats to the business models. We're not talking about Napster here. We're not talking about direct substitutes in most cases. We're talking about things that, sure, new opportunities, ancillary businesses. I understand why rights holders want to be cut in on it. But this isn't their industry is going to disappear and dry up tomorrow if we don't clamp down today.
I'm really sorry that I'm sitting between Sarah and Fred and Alec, but maybe I'll pass the baton down the way. I have to side a little bit, actually 100% with Sarah on the definition of service provider. If you go to the Copyright Office website and look who's registered as service providers, there are a lot of surprises there, but I uniformly in my law practice recommend to any website that they register as a service provider, and I think they fall within the definition. BMI, ASCAP, the rights societies themselves have registered as service providers. And I think that's the appropriate way to go. The DMCA, the legislative history, to understand a statute, you got to read the words, but we're not courts, so we don't have to do a plain meaning analysis. But if you go behind the words and you look at the history of 512, it was an effort to codify safe practices, best practices, reasonable business practices. That was the breakthrough in the DMCA. It said, why don't we develop sort of a best practices in Section 512. What would reasonable businesses do? That's the history of Section 512. You get a notice, you take it down, you know, you do all these things. You register, you make your registration publicly available. So I think that leads to another point. And Peter, I think you know this, but we have a lot of copyright lawyers in the room. How many of you have heard of the photography guidelines for copying in photo stores? If there's any industry that is sort of like YouTube, it's photography. When you think about going to your local photo store and having your photographs developed, or getting your reprints of your mom and dad's wedding anniversary, or getting a CD, there are rampant copyright infringements that go on at the store counter. Well, the photo industry, Peter, I just remind you, and you're aware of this, and David Carson is aware of it, has guidelines that were negotiated between the professional photographers, ASMP, the Professional Photographers of America, and the photo finishers, including the big behemoth companies, you know, Kodak, Fuji, Konica, those guidelines have actually led, they were negotiated about 10 years ago, and you know what? There has not been a single lawsuit, reported lawsuit, I don't think there's been a single lawsuit for copyright infringement in the photo industry space, which is increasingly digital. So I would commend you to look at those, dust them off. I was going to ask, how many people in this room have heard of the photo industry copying guidelines? Okay, well, we've got a smattering. You know, the president, the wife of the president of Kodak went in to get some photos of her husband, and she was in the photo. And the store clerk said, did you take this photo? You're in it. You can't possibly be the author. And they turned her away. Well, that was probably the wrong thing to do, but sometimes copyright is underprotected and sometimes it's overprotected. We're looking for, Fred used the word balance, and I do think that's an important word.
I think it's undeniable to answer Rob's first question that 512 has kind of put us in a situation where we have user-generated content platforms, and it's no mistake, as Fred said. I think it's no mistake because it's my understanding, having talked to other folks at EFF, that YouTube actually consulted with EFF before rolling out their service, and one of the reasons why they decided to actually... Oh, okay. That's what Jason said at a panel I was on at Duke Law. That YouTube consulted with them, and that the reason I was questioning why they would choose to actually store the content on their own servers, which would make them, you would think, you know, potentially more liable since the content's on their own servers, they're making the copy. And Jason told me that he actually advised them to do that because he thought it was a better fit for them under 512C than other provisions of 512. To the point of, does 512 cover this? And you know, I remember with some fondness, because it's long enough ago now, when Sarah and I were sitting on the opposite side of the table with Troy Dow heading some of the negotiations over 512, and Ed Damich, another Hatch staffer, and this all on the Senate side, and we had these long, long arguments about how the section was going to be drafted. And the decision was made, look, there's no way you can define services narrowly enough. So you have these broad definitions, provider of online service or network access. But that's because the safe harbor only extends to those entities when they're engaged in a specific function. So it doesn't matter if you're a provider of online service. That isn't like some magic pill that gets you in and now you're safe. You're only covered if you're providing, if you're engaged in the actual function at that point in time, and then of course you don't meet any of the other provisions, financial benefit, etc. And again, I don't think we'll see if we see this case go to court, but I don't think that argument holds for something like YouTube, which is doing a heck of a lot more than just storing people's content. It is a media service, a media site, and that's how they market themselves. To Steve's point, he's absolutely right. My company would much rather see proactive solutions than reactive solutions. That's why I talked about filtering.
It is an enormous burden on us and a huge expense for us to be sending out the number of notices we do, contracting with the outside vendors, and the tremendous amount of cross-checking that we do to make sure that the notices we send out are all accurate. I don't think, frankly, that the 60 or 70 false positives, I guess I would call them, out of Viacom's 150,000 is a bad number. That's an error rate of less than 0.015%. That's a pretty low amount out of the 150,000 notices they sent out. But nonetheless, my company spends a lot of time checking each notice before we send it out. That is not a solution that we prefer. We prefer a solution where a site like YouTube would implement filtering, and it would be proactive in determining that our content is not licensed to be up there, and they won't let it get put there in the first place. I guess I'll leave that there.
I think, having had the opportunity to go last on the first round, that I will defer to the audience.
All right. Well, we have about 20 minutes left, and we'd like to get some questions from the audience. If you would step up to one of the microphones and give your name and affiliation, and also please ask questions.
Hi, Jonathan Zittrin from Oxford University. And I wanted to ask a somewhat prosaic question that I think might have bigger implications, though. And it's really a question for Sarah, but then anybody else who wants to kick in. And that is that there seems like there's a shoe that hasn't dropped yet on DMCA with respect to Verizon and other first-order internet service providers. There's a lot of talk about YouTube and other online application layer providers and trying to get them to take down copyright infringing materials. But for peer-to-peer and even sources of materials that end up on YouTube, as long as you can get an IP address and it turns out to be a subscriber of, say, Verizon, I suppose you could say that if on notification Verizon fails to terminate the user account, they are then not going to get the safe harbors under one interpretation because they are not terminating repeat infringers. So I wanted to ask, first, does Verizon terminate the accounts of people that haven't been adjudicated as repeat infringers, but there's surely a pretty good amount of smoke coming out of the gun that says they've been trading Radiohead albums for the past 3 weeks and don't appear to be stopping? And second, how much do you see this as kind of the dog that hasn't yet barked, and should it bark, could change the landscape of things? Because if I've only got one or two options for high-speed broadband at my house, and I know that if I get caught trading files, that's it, I lose it, that, even if I'm a teenager, might influence my behavior. Thanks.
Well, yeah, this termination of repeat infringer issue is an important one, and Verizon does terminate repeat infringers, and be glad to take down the IP address of your teenager, and we'll make them. Well, those are the issues. I mean, the issue under the DMCA, I'm trying to find the little section, is 512i, you have to have a reasonably implement, I'm trying to look for it here. Yeah, it's a policy, a reasonable implementation of a policy for the termination of repeat infringers. It doesn't define what a repeat infringer is. It requires the reasonable implementation of a policy. And so we do have such a policy, but I think the tension is that some in the content community would like the ISPs just to automatically terminate everyone. You could get a notice at 5:05 p.m. and then a second notice at 5:10 and now a notice at 5:15. Now you've got a repeat infringer. And the question is, how do you determine who is an infringer and what evidence is there? And with the ISP not having knowledge of what the infringer did, or a Wi-Fi network, for example, there are some severe implications from terminating your subscribers here, because the internet now is a lifeline for people. It's a voice product. And, you know, what if it's Joe Smith and we get a different Joe Smith? Do we terminate them? Do we terminate them forever? These are the issues, I think, that we've seen some good case law here on termination of repeat infringers, but it is an issue that we need to discuss and be concerned about.
And I'm just wondering, how many have been so terminated?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, yeah, quite a few have been terminated. But usually there's, you know, some specific knowledge and specific cause to do so. But, yeah, we're you know, we take it seriously, and we also have a deal with Disney where we have agreed to forward notices. So we want to take action here, but you can't just, you know, just wholesale remedies like filtering and termination are very severe and have implications that need to be considered.
Thank
Yeah, I just want to note on that issue, David Nimmer, who writes the sort of leading copyright treatise, has actually put in his latest revision a lengthy treatment of this particular part of the DMCA and probably the most, you know, full exploration of it. And his conclusion is DMCA takedown notices do not a repeat infringer make. In other words, if you just happen to get a notice, you know, under the DMCA that this content infringes our rights, that shouldn't automatically be strike one, strike two, and you lose your broadband access. Because often it's not clear whether or not a particular thing is actually infringing. If it were to go to court or not, the rights holder is entitled to ask for it to be taken down without that ultimate decision ever being made. But you do put your finger on an interesting way to put leverage on end users. And Professor Tony Reese and Mark Lemley from University of Texas and Stanford, respectively, wrote an article in which they suggested maybe a way to get a hold of the peer-to-peer file sharing problem is to create a system where if they catch you, you know, maybe more than once, you are banned from all broadband internet access in the country forever. Or unless there's a specific high risk, more expensive, or something like that. And I wonder if maybe that would be more of a deterrent than a $3,000 fine in an RIAA lawsuit. Hard to say. I mean, obviously, that's not what the statute currently requires. I think that would be an overreaction for all the reasons Sarah mentioned. The internet is not just about downloading music. It's now increasingly a lifeline for college students. It's education. Who knows? So, but that is a. I wonder the same question you do. Why hasn't that been litigated more? We did just have a decision out of the Ninth Circuit last week, a couple weeks ago, so there's a little law, but not much.
One other tiny point is that many places in the DMCA, they create duties based on where there's an act of apparent infringement. 512I says that you will terminate, have a policy for terminating where they are repeat infringers of copyright. So I would argue that there must be some higher level of certainty than just apparent.
Lawyers parsing, isn't that the best?
just to sort of sound the familiar old theme, it seems to me that that question and the high stakes that are involved in termination of service underline again the importance of trying to develop robust shared understandings of fair use in this space. Because in fact, many of those so-called infringers who are going to get the takedown notices that have been generated by automated or semi-automated means may well, especially if they are operating in the space of participatory media, have very, very strong, even compelling, fair use claims.
My name is Tyler Patterson. I'm a 2L here at WCL. My question is actually somewhat anticipated, I think, by one of the comments earlier about the RIAA letters that are being sent to college students around the country, these pre-litigation letters, which are offering a $3,000 settlement to college students because apparently some computer that they had access to was their IP address was tracked to the downloading of music in an unauthorized way. And they're using, I guess, universities in order to track down who these people are, that sort of thing. I think that my question is more in respect to litigation strategies or strategies being employed by organizations such as the RIAA. And its overall effect on the, I guess, on the industry and on consumers of the industry. I think in some respects in the 90s, the music industry is an example of how not to adapt to changing business models. And I can kind of see a response to the mistakes that were being made in a form like this, in this call for cooperation among all the interested parties. But so I wanted to get an idea of kind of what sort of lessons do you think or learned from those experiences in the 90s, and is the RIAA basically making some of those same mistakes again by targeting you know, these students are obviously not going to be able to afford a long, protracted litigation to defend themselves.
Well, I mean, my company's not a member of the RIAA, and we don't have music, and so we're not part of those lawsuits. But, you know, we through MPAA, have actually filed some suits, not necessarily targeting college students, but I think some have come up in that. College campus piracy is a huge problem for the movie industry. There's a survey recently done in the last year of the losses suffered by the movie industry, and this is a conservative estimate. This isn't, the bogus claim made that, oh, we're counting every file on the internet as a lost $19 DVD. This is based on consumer surveys sent out asking people to identify themselves, identify whether they download, and if they do download, you know, and also are you a college student, among other things, and what would you pay if you couldn't download anymore for a legitimate DVD? And if the answer was 5 cents, that was the loss that was counted. If the answer was zero, zero is what was counted. So based on that survey, we found that over $500 million of the loss, of the $6.1 billion loss that the movie industry suffers globally, over $500 million is caused by U.S. college students. That's a huge number. It's over 44% of our domestic loss. Now, maybe it doesn't surprise you. You all were just recently in college. If you're in law school now, you know what goes on campus and how much downloading. But it's a huge number. It's a big problem. And we fully stand by, you know, our sister industry's right to file lawsuits against students if that's what they think they need to do. You know, we're working, trying to be a little more proactive, and they've tried this for a while too, with getting universities to implement best practices, what we're calling best practices, fourfold best practices. One, having education policies that are very clearly identified to students about what is and is not allowed on campus vis-a-vis downloading. Two, enforce those. How many campuses, you know, have actually put students on probation, suspension, disciplined them in some way for being caught a second, a third time downloading? Not a whole lot. We think schools should enforce those policies. Third, they should implement things like filtering technologies. Again, there are 70 or 80 campuses around the country now who are using filtering technologies to prevent the trading of copyright infringing works. And lastly, they should be giving students access to legitimate services. There's, as I pointed out, there's a ton of legitimate content out there. Campuses are providing students with free cable TV. They're providing students with other subsidized forms of entertainment. We think they should be, and we're willing to work with them, providing students ways to access the content legally while they cut off the illegal access.
Here's one thing that I want to say, too, because we had this discussion earlier in the day, and it's really important to distinguish. And a lot of times, my former colleagues in the content community, in particular in Hollywood, don't want to make this distinction, but it's really significant. There's what we had, I guess I tried to make it into two, and one of our fellow panelists this afternoon was making it into three buckets. So I'll try to dignify it that way. There's the DVR. You forgot to record something overnight, and so you're the DVR for the world in that you upload literally the clip, or you download a song verbatim, exactly what was available legitimately through content. Then there's all of the stuff that you saw up here, which is what I would put on the other end, which is really, you know, I'm not so sure that transformative actually means anything, but I'll use the term because a lot of people think it does, that those are transformative uses of copyrighted content where there actually is creativity and there's energy and originality that's put to it. A lot of times people want to conflate those two back together, and the third bucket is the gray area in between. And I think it's really important, if we're going to actually make some hope of meeting in the middle, the one way that the creative communities need to be accommodated as well as content owners need to be accommodated is to understand that there are core scenarios in both of those two extremes that are actually probably should be protected and continue to be protected. It's the gray stuff in the middle that's so troublesome. So in the case of music downloads, that's very different to me than a lot of the stuff that you saw up here. And I hope none of us are making the mistake of putting them all in the same bucket.
Yeah, if I could just add, you conflated a number of things, and I would agree with the previous comments. When you said the music industry hasn't developed adequate business models, there are a couple rights at play. There's the public performance. And YouTube, Google, they're licensed. They're licensed for public performances by ASCAP and BMI and presumably CSAC. So all that we saw there, everything actually, the no zone, the gray zone, the yes zone, has a license for the public performance. It's just a question of, and I understand that it's in rate court now, so it's just a question of price. The downloads, you know, that's a different issue. Those cut into the bone of the movie companies and the recording labels. I think they're engaging in a deterrence strategy. Changes are occurring on college campuses through education. I think they have more of an affirmative burden in the educational realm than Alec alluded to. Universities have finite resources. They're sort of like a technology mandate that they don't have the staffs and educational resources to do it, so we ought to have much more of a cooperative effort.
If what I'm hearing is the movie industry wants $500 million that would otherwise go to higher education to flow into their pockets, then I think the answer is hell no. And in fact, if you look, relay some facts, which I and everyone up here knows, but maybe you all don't know. The movie industry has been enjoying its most profitable years and largest grossing years in history for the past 10 years running, on the back largely of DVD sales, which have been very, very good to them. So this isn't a business that is being crushed by college students who are mercilessly driving them into the dirt, right? Far from it, right? So the other thing is, let's talk about the lawsuits, right? The recording industry has filed more than 20,000 lawsuits. How many more, we don't know, because they won't say anymore. The motion picture industry has filed what they've admitted are thousands of lawsuits against individuals. They won't admit how many thousands. Those lawsuits are routinely brought against individuals, against their parents, against their grandparents, and generally they are settled in amounts between $3,000 and $5,000, not because people know they're guilty, not because we've ever gone to court on these, but rather because it's more expensive to defend, even if you're innocent, than it would be just to pay out the settlement. And if one believes, as Mike mentions, that this is a deterrent strategy on their part, it's been a glorious and fantastic failure, right? Peer-to-peer file sharing is more common today than it was when these lawsuits began. Now, of course, they will argue, well, it would be even more prevalent if we weren't filing these lawsuits. Well, whether or not that's true, plainly the lawsuits aren't working. They aren't actually turning the tide. They're not bringing your customers back. The reason they're not bringing your customers back, I would suggest, is because you're not yet selling the right product to them. And I think there are moves afoot. I think the motion picture industry has been much better than the music industry. I think you're right. The motion picture industry has sort of learned from some of the mistakes that the recording industry has made and continues to make. I think EMI is beginning to learn a little bit. They're saying we're going to give our music, make it available online without DRM, so you can finally put it on your iPod, even if you didn't buy it from the iTunes Music Store, or on your Creative Zen if you did buy it from the iTunes Music Store. I think that's all good, finally. But the lawsuits, I think, have to stop. They're not doing any good. They're basically targeting a few individuals for what we know is going on everywhere. I mean, my attitude when college kids get sued is you should go around to the rest of your dorm mates and take up a collection to cover your settlement, because there, but for the grace of God, go all the rest of them. And so from my perspective, sure, universities and their students ought to pay. I think compensation is fair. I think that we should create a collective licensing arrangement where universities can pay, not $500 million, I'm sorry, but maybe a handful of dollars per month per student. I don't think that would be crippling. I do think the reality is students are going to get their music, they're going to increasingly get their video from the internet, so it's only fair. But in exchange for that, send the lawyers home. Stop picking on individual students and individual parents and individual grandparents in an effort basically to put a head on a pike to scare everybody else. Right, I don't think that's ever worked before. It shows no sign of working now. So I'm hoping that the university community can get together and say, we will raise a pot of money and pay you. And in exchange, the content industry will get together and say, okay, we'll take the pot of money and leave your students alone. Because a world where we're going to sue people and install network monitoring and surveillance, which will in turn be overcome by next generation technologies, is a rat hole that just costs everybody money and doesn't get a single creator paid.
I'm Tamara Teslovich. I'm the new IP Society President for American, and I'm also an examiner at the Patent Office for the DRM technology. So I kind of have both sides. My question to you is, What effect do you think that Jobs' most recent announcements about pulling DRM from the music will have on the music community, whether students and everyone alike will push to actually buy things legitimately, and if this works, the effect that it will have on the other industries?
DRM in music is dead. I think that's been increasingly clear for a long time. Jobs was simply saying the same thing that Yahoo Music's executives had been saying months before, that Rhapsody's music executives had been saying months before, and that we've been saying for years. DRM makes no sense on music. It has no value proposition for fans. It has no value proposition for creators, and increasingly no value proposition for music industries. Now, so I think it's going the way of the dodo. I think eMusic is the second most popular download store on the internet. They sell with no DRM, so obviously it can be done. It can be done successfully. A huge number of independent labels, you know, if you're looking for the Decemberists record, if you're looking for all the indie music that's currently gaining ground in the market, it's all on eMusic with no DRM. On the video side, the story couldn't be more different. In video, I think we're going to see DRM for the foreseeable future. I think we're going to see increasingly locked down standards that consumers are going to face. And increasingly, that's going to take your fair use rights away from you, only to sell them back to you later for a small incremental additional fee, which we already see. For example, Warner Brothers and Walmart has a deal where when you buy a DVD, for a small incremental additional fee, they'll allow you to put a copy of it on your personal media player. And for a small additional incremental fee above that, they'll allow you to have a copy on your computer. Of course, when I buy a CD, I'm allowed to make those copies without having to pay again. But those are the wages of DRM. It doesn't work to stop piracy. Everyone admits that, right? Every movie that's released on DVD is ripped and uploaded to peer-to-peer networks immediately. Anybody can download Handbrake or, you know, any of the many DVD shrink, any of the many tools that allows you to rip DVDs yourself for free. So what's it good for? Well, it's good for controlling the technology platform. In the video market, content owners, large studios have used DRM in order to create a market where, in order to build a playback device, you have to sign up for a license. So the DRM on DVD has been cracked for years. Everybody knows it. It's really now basically a joke. But can you build a DVD player today without signing a DVD CCA license? No. Those are the wages of DRM there. And so as long as the movie studio community can use DRM in order to control the feature set, the rate of innovation, the kinds of products that can be brought to market, and the kinds of business models those products will support, DRM is going to be with us on video until the law has changed.
In answer to your question, because I don't think you just got one, I think that it'll be really interesting to see what happens with the MI's recent decision. I mean, will this result in increased revenue for EMI? Will they see, in fact, their sales plunge because now people get the sense that, you know, it's unprotected, there's no attempt to protect it, I can, you know, share it willy-nilly. I mean, that'll be the test case. In other words, the answer to your question is kind of now out there. We'll see what happens with EMI and how their sales go up, go down. In response to a couple points Fred made, I mean, you know, I think that he says everyone acknowledges that DRM is a failure. Last time I went into Best Buy, I looked as hard as I could, and I couldn't find a DCSS machine. Sure, it's available on the internet. Sure, you can go and get the ripping software, and there are much better rips than DCSS now. But the whole point is your average consumer cannot go and get a product today that enables them to rip a DVD. Why? Because DRM has and the DMCA behind it have worked to that extent. Another point is, you know, he just kind of blithely said that Walmart and I think he was referring to Warner are taking away people's fair use rights by charging them for the ability to make a copy for their personal device, a copy for their hard drive. That's not a fair use. I don't know where he gets that. Making a backup of a DVD is not a fair use. If it were, why would we have Section 117 of the code that says you need a specific section of the code to make a backup of a computer software program? Why do you need the Audio Home Recording Act? I'll speak for movies, but I think a lot of what he says is a blithe assertion of stuff that we certainly take issue with.
As the only person here who actually is a DRM manufacturer, I have to take 10 seconds here. I think the argument that we would make, and I think there's a lot of people in the content community that would make the same thing, is the minor inconvenience, I'm using their words, not mine, the minor inconvenience that you get from DRM is a trade-off for the width of content that you can get. There's a lot more available because DRM allows people to figure out a way to make a business model off of it. That being said, I will tell you as a consumer that it's interesting that it was EMI, not Universal Music Group, that made that claim. That may tell you something.
Professor Nesson, you've been waiting patiently. I just want to add, this is our last question. If we could keep the comments brief so that we have time to move to our reception afterwards, but please.
I want to come at this from the point of view of the university, and the university not just as one university, but university. Imagine that we represent, I represent a consortium of the universities of the world, and I'm approaching this negotiation with the copyright forces. I would like to open the negotiation by putting on the table how much the copyright industry has forced us, university, to spend our money and resources to protect your property. If you think of it in terms of what's happened to our librarians, you go back and imagine what was it to be a librarian in the university in 1990. It was a job of connecting people with books. If you ask now what the librarian's job is, they're the copyright police. The university spends a ton of money being your police. And what I would like to see is the universities open the negotiation with you by collectively aggregating the expense that we have been forced to pay in order to enforce your property rights. That, to me, looks like a form of slavery on us. That's an imposed taking of our energy. And we have people who are, you know, basically into academics who now have to be spending their life being, in touch with the law office and all sorts of nonsense. So I don't think it's just a given that somehow the university is the bad guy in this world. To me, I see the copyright industry having intruded upon the university in a way that is just remarkably aggressive. And at this point, it seems to me that if there's going to be a negotiation, it would make sense for university to kind of get its act together first before they sit down at the table with you and make a deal that actually has our costs in it. What do you think?
I think it's interesting, both the point in time you picked out and the way you put it. I mean, first of all, I'd like to point out Harvard is actually one of the best schools in the best practices area. They've done almost all the things, and in fact, I think Harvard has a really strict, like they actually throw students out when they catch them downloading. It's that strict.
And think of what that's done to our university.
And your point of 1990, what it was to be a librarian, and now, I would love to sit down and find out why that is. Is that because since 1990, in the advent of the digital world, the opportunities to make fair uses of copyrighted works and make other uses has expanded so prolifically? And universities have gone into areas they were never in before, interlibrary loan, digital distance education, electronic course packs, providing people with computer networks that put content online. Is it because the areas that they have gone into has so dramatically expanded that, in fact, they are making far more uses of copyrighted works than they ever did before in far more innovative ways, but in ways that implicate copyright owners' rights a lot more? Is it because you intruded on us by using our stuff in new and different ways, getting new exceptions in the copyright law to allow you to do that, 108, 110, 108B, you know, so on and so forth? And is that really where the conflict has come, where there was peace before? You all have great excitement and understandable excitement at the idea to be able to offer your students these great new ways to use copyrighted works that digital technology allows you to do. But that means you're trying to offer them more ability to exercise copyright owners' rights than they ever have before, and therefore has brought into conflict with us.
Let me just say that this is Janet Freeses here. We just finished the university. This is public performing right. We have a mixture of rights at play here because they're divisible. But the university, NPR, PBS, Section 118 negotiation was just successfully negotiated for the fifth time in six tries. There was one litigation, I think, in 98, and that covers public performances at universities for football, dorm rooms, fraternities, music schools, student union. You know, you think of every use of music on a college campus where it's performed, transmitted, and that hasn't been accepted by the Copyright Royalty Board, but it was just successfully submitted.
And it's a blanket.
It's a blanket. It's a collective license, one payment, a whole year, no monitoring. But I'm not taking anything away from the owners of the reproduction and distribution rights and the performance right and the sound recording. There are other rights, but it can be done. You do need antitrust exemptions for the negotiation. I don't think the studios have that antitrust exemption. I don't think the universities have it, but it does exist in a compulsory license in the Copyright Act, Section 118, for the public performance only.
Your theme kind of about kind of co-opting others as long as it's for the enforcement of rights has kind of hit a raw nerve, because this is not a copyright issue, but we have been a victim of pretexting, you know, as communication companies, where these pretexters call, they get our customers' information under false pretext, their call records. This has been the subject of numerous state bills and federal bills. There's a bill in California that bans getting information from any company under false pretexting, and we heard last week that the recording industry wrote a letter to the senator sponsoring the bill saying that an intellectual property, a copyright owner, or their agent or trade association should have the right to engage in pretexting, and they use those words, so long as it was for the enforcement of intellectual property rights. So this, you know, struck us as a bit too much.
I believe the MPAA has joined that letter as well.
Well, we're out of time. And so on behalf of Washington College of Law Program, Information Justice and Intellectual Property, the American University Center for Social Media, and the DC chapter of the Copyright Society of the USA, we want to thank our panel and thank all of you.